All right, is this on? Can you hear me? Technology. Technology, come on. Oh, there we go. Good morning. This is going to be, this was to be expected. I set up in the middle of a hallway, and that's totally fine. I apologize to all the people that are not here yet that are going to pass through and feel totally awkward in the middle of a classroom, but that's I need this screen is really the thing. I need this technology in order to tell you why this whole thing is a mistake. All this technology is a big mistake. Just a few words for the sake of my dear brother Britton. Had some conversations about his introduction to technology. He had some wonderful, interesting theoretical things to say and philosophical. And some people, what they heard in that is, oh, this is going to be a completely anti-tech, like Sunday school series. Like, we're going to have you guys all acting like Mennonites or ultra-Orthodox or something like that. And that's absolutely not true. Britton and I use technology every day. You guys use technology every day. And we rejoice. And I think that one of the ways in which... You guys can come through. It's my fault. One of the ways in which we really ought to approach all technology is with a measure of gratitude. We have been greatly blessed. It's a sign of blessing to live in a time of great innovation, and that's definitely my attitude. I was going through all of the ways in which my life has changed in the last 20 years from digital technology. And there are so many things that you can start to kind of lose count of ways in which we've really been blessed. But as Neil Postman said, there is always a cost behind every technology, every single one. There is always, you do not simply add technology to the world that you live in. You change the world that you live in with that technology. Adding the printing press to the early modern period didn't just simply now have the early modern period plus a printing press. It completely changed. It changed the world. Okay? You now, there's really in some ways no going back once you introduce these technologies. So we're not, strictly speaking, Luddites. Here, at least Britton and I can't speak for everyone else. We're not Luddites. We're not trying to stop the growth of technology. But as Christians, we ought to always be reflective on how is this impacting our world that we live in? How is it impacting the ministry? How is it impacting discipleship? In other words, we need to be very critical of all technologies because technologies come always with great effects in the world. The digital revolution is no different. So we're mostly going to be talking today about harms of the digital revolution. I'm going to paint the landscape of mostly of harms, but we will begin with this. I want you guys to just muse with me some of these are old-timey words now. When did all of this happen? Okay? Such that now, there's only a couple of words up here that I think even Gen Z wouldn't recognize. They never knew this. What would those words be?
MP3.
CD-ROM. MySpace. What is Netscape? Netscape used to be huge. And there's a couple of words up here that maybe you're not familiar with at all. This is not in chronological order. This is my random mind just recollecting my experience the last 20 years. You probably share this experience where someone says, oh, can you just Bluetooth this over? Can you Bluetooth connection here? And you're like, I don't know what that means. Every one of us had to have that kind of experience at some point with all of these things. I remember trying to get my head around Wi-Fi. Like, I heard people talking about Wi-Fi. And okay. I think that's interesting. You mean we're, like, it's like, and you're just getting your head around what that means, and you don't know that in 10 years, in 15 years, it's going to be so ubiquitous and so much a part of, go ahead and come on in, so much a part of our world that everybody is kind of native to it now. We're just kind of used to it. And we really can't imagine life without it. That's kind of the strange thing. Personal computer. That used to be a revolutionary idea. I remember going to my Uncle Steve's house, and he was in the early 80s. I was a young little guy, and he was an early adopter of personal computers. We did not have a computer in our house, and he had like three. He was a computer teacher at a school. And boy, we were fascinated with that, playing Oregon Trail and whatever else. But back in the day, in order to play games, you put disks in, floppy disks. You sat for 5 minutes. You played for 5 minutes. You exchanged out floppy disks. It was quite a thing, but it was amazing. It felt amazing to us. Bert, what were you going to say?
How much memory was on that
first? Not a lot. Probably like a thousandth of the amount of memory, or maybe a millionth of the amount of memory on our smartphones is tiny, right? What is another word that you guys would say belongs up here that I forgot? That something that has become a part of our world, a word or an idea or a technology related to digital media? Social media? Mm-hmm. I just listed out the different social media. There's probably even new social media. I didn't put Twitch up here, which is an interesting kind of quasi-social media / content. Siri? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Who?
Selfies.
Yeah.
Camera in your pocket.
Having a camera in your pocket. Yes. Which has changed the world, right? There was a really, when LeBron James went past Kareem in the scoring title, they showed a picture side by side with Michael Jordan. I don't remember what it was, but he was winning a championship or something like that, some jump shot last game. And so the two shots looked the same. They were both shooting a jump shot, but in the background, completely different. Completely different. You had, with Jordan, all these people going like this, you know, and like, you know, and then every person in the LeBron James, in that whole stadium, was that at Staples Center? I think it was in LA. Every single person was looking at it through a phone and capturing the experience. No judgment on that. It's just that the world has changed a lot. So the world has changed. This is what I like to call a kind of cleaned up picture of the last 20 years. Depending on what you choose to focus on, if you go to YouTube and you just type in history of the digital revolution, you can get someone who will stand up in front of people and tell a story. And it will be like this. It will be one great breakthrough after another. One great breakthrough after another. But what you choose to include in that story depends a lot on how you view and how you remember that story. There was a lot of other things going on during this time. There is massive upheaval that is taking place in the world. So I want you to remember the last 20 to 25 years, do you also remember when these things became something that grabbed your attention? Maybe you don't know what these things are, but they are all related to the digital revolution. Okay? There was a time when guys in my high school had to sneak into mini markets to steal pornography. Okay? There was a time when it was still around quite a bit, but it was rather rare, and socially it occupied a completely different space in society than it does now. The word and the only word that comes to mind today is ubiquitous. It's ubiquitous. The age groups which are accessing this, it's going down lower than anybody, even secular people, feel comfortable with. Many secular people, not all secular people. Instagram whistleblower Frances Hudgens came out just a few years ago, left Instagram and Facebook, and brought with her all these documents showing that Instagram, which is Facebook, which is Meta, which is, who knows, brought with her all these documents showing that Instagram knew absolutely that young ladies' lives are being torn apart by Instagram. They're fully aware. In fact, they are conducting the single greatest, most thorough scientific analysis of human behavior and how it responds to social media. This is happening at Facebook, Instagram, TikTok. The data that they have and what their data scientists are looking at is so far beyond what like researchers at Harvard and Yale and these places have because they don't get to see all the data. They only share what they're willing to share, which helps their bottom line. But a whistleblower came out and showed all this documentation. They're absolutely aware of how harmful their content is, but trying to convince a billionaire to let go of their golden goose is it's impossible, okay? So Reddit, 4chan, how many young men's lives have spiraled into a really, really dark place in the last 20, 25 years? Because they found themselves in these chat groups that radicalized, twisted their minds, their ideologies, and the parents not being fully aware, the school teachers not being fully aware, the pastors not being fully aware of what's going on, watch a young man spiral and are like, what's going on with this guy? What's going on with this guy? There was a shooting at a synagogue in Southern California, Escondido. A pastor's kid, he was an elder's kid, had been just spiraling down into this really, really dark conspiracy theory place. I think it was 4chan, I don't know. And was becoming increasingly violent and radicalized. And he got a hold of a gun and he went into a synagogue and shot it up. Now, that's unfortunately not uncommon these days to hear stories like that, but what was interesting is the community knew nothing about it. They said this was a young man who went to the local Christian school, was an outstanding young man. How did this happen? Well, he was in this other world, in this other community, right? We could go on and on here. Some of the things that are interesting, this is one of those things that is really interesting to me. TikTok, which originated in China, is effectively banned by China, except they allow for a very, very modified version of it that is cleaned up and only at certain times of day, and only for maybe a couple of hours a day. What is released in America has all of the restraints off. It's like, hey, sorry. It's almost like a form of psychological warfare. Okay, the Twitter files. I don't know if you guys have followed this, showing how media, on the one hand, says we don't do this, we don't do this, we don't do this, and at the same time, this is another whistleblower thing. They are suppressing information, blocking people out. They're doing all kinds of things to manipulate people. It's manipulation. It's not just the free expression of ideas, all ideas out here. They weighed progressive ideas and progressive people differently than they weighed conservatives, and that's what that was about. This didn't come out from some super conservative. I think it came from Elon Musk, Barry Weiss, a lesbian former editor of the New York Times. These were people who were outraged because what was being revealed was there was this heavy hand on the scales of the media, which was presented as being objective and everybody gets their fair sheet. We could go on. This one's an interesting one, Cambridge Analytica, the selling and mining of people's data without their consent. I like this one. This was a really interesting moment. I remember when this happened. To me, it was very poignant, listening to a senator who's on the, I don't remember if it was Ways and Means, I don't remember which committee it was, but it was probably, anyway, he was grilling Mark Zuckerberg about Facebook and all the harmful effects, and he asked, how does Facebook even make money? What did that reveal at that moment? What did we learn about our leaders? They're naive. They don't understand what's going on. They don't, you know, there is a generational gap. It's a very, very difficult thing. The majority of our senators are boomers and some Gen Xers, okay? And they don't understand the world, the digital world of Gen Z and the millennials much at all. And so there's a huge generational gap problem of having these people oversee and regulate what's having on. Anyway, we could go on. There's a lot of interesting things. This is one of the interesting stories of a few years ago of a doctor who noticed an increase of people. I think I mentioned this in a sermon once. You guys remember this? And the sermon on madness and how she was noticing people show up at her clinic with tics like they had Tourette's. And no one could figure out what this is. This happened during the COVID thing. Remember the COVID thing? And it happened during that time. And people's online usage went way up, including TikTok. And these young ladies, it was especially young ladies, were showing up at clinics with unstoppable facial tics and verbal tics. They also had verbal tics. And if young people, you don't know what a tic is, it's an uncontrollable kind of like almost like a reflexive behavior that you can't stop. Your face just like keeps muscle contractions and things like that. And they couldn't figure it out. And what they found out was that the one thing that all these people had in common is they watched Tourette's videos on TikTok. And they watched hours and hours and hours. And this is the most amazing thing. The researcher herself, who had to go into that and dive into that, developed a facial tic herself. Okay, so do you also remember this? And we could go on and on. Polarization and all of the things that have happened in the last 20 years. So as you tell the story of the digital revolution, it's important to remember that it has not been without massive social problems. It's been problematic. Okay. Now I want to say that I'm going to refer to Generation Z or Gen Z. Sometimes it's referred to as iGen. By this lady originated that term, iGen, Gene Twenge. These are people. It's called in social science, it's called a cohort. People that were born all around the same time and share certain characteristics. So the boomers, we have then Gen X. Millennials, those were people who came of age right around the turn into the millennium. And then you have Gen Z. They were born from 1995 to 2012. Okay? And I don't know why 2012. I think it actually has something to do with the rise of Instagram, of something that changed during that time. Or why they stopped there. But you got to stop somewhere. But the thing that they have in, thing that all that group has in common that's distinct from millennials is millennials remember a time when there weren't smartphones. Gen Z grew up with smartphones. They grew up with a lot of smartphones. It was the world that they were born into. It's what they know. They're called digital natives. They've just grown up in this. So we can learn a lot by looking at research that's being done on Gen Z and ways in which Generation Z is different from generations that have come before. There's a lot to be garnered from that. There's a lot to be learned, okay? Because the change is dramatic, to say the least. It is less pronounced in the church. It's less pronounced in conservative communities. It's less pronounced in rural communities, for instance. It's less pronounced, obviously, in traditional communities outside of the U.S., communities that have a strong cultural fiber. The U.S., as much as we would like to believe otherwise, does not actually have a very, very strong unifying cultural tradition. Okay, it's weaker than some cultures where ethnicity and tradition and religion bind them together in stronger ways. In cultures like that, these effects are less pronounced. Okay, so what that would suggest is that the digital revolution has a stronger impact where there aren't other things that act as a buffer and as a guard against that change, is how I would explain it. You might be wondering by this point, it just occurred to me, I thought this was Bible study. I see we have Rachel's parents here. Is that right? Welcome. Glad you guys are here. We don't always do social science in our Bible study. I'm trying to set us up for next week. I hope you guys are going to stay for 3 weeks. I don't know if that's true. But we're going to dive into what does this have to do with Christian discipleship in the next couple weeks. I'm trying to set the stage for where we're going. Okay, so Gen Z, they grew up with smartphones. They are a generation that has been, I think it's safe to say, I'm going to try to pick my words here carefully. They are the generation, more than any other generation, that has been experimented upon with radical new technologies, not having any idea what effects this is going to have in the long term. Let's see what happens. Let's give them this and see what happens. And we're learning a lot. Okay? One thing that we know is true about Generation Z is that they are increasingly identifying religiously as not as agnostic, not as atheistic, just none. I think this is one of the most interesting, sad, and tragic developments of recent times. It's not that they're growing up with strong atheistic convictions. There actually aren't good reasons to be an atheist. And I think the more people sometimes dive into those things, they realize that it leads to nihilism and it leads to all sorts of dark and evil places. And they like to have the idea of God somewhere in there. But what is your religious identification? They just say, nothing. There's just nothing there. There's just nothing there. And that is the type of language and that is the type of ideology that is there in a people that have been radically changed to think differently about deep philosophical issues. They simply don't engage. It's not something of which they have developed strong convictions about at all, because what they have been fed is entertainment and a whole bunch of social issues that are more present in the immediacy. They are very politically activistic, not active, but politically activistic. They have strong opinions about things around them. But in terms of philosophical issues and meaning of life issues, they're not being fed a diet of reflection and thoughtfulness. So there's simply not much of a place for them to come to convictions. You could say it like this. It's not on the agenda. Is this something that we're supposed to be doing, is developing strong religious convictions or something like that? What is being given to them is another agenda. Okay? And so you will remember that Gen X was somewhat less religious than the boomers. Maybe you won't remember, but those of you in the room who have watched over the late in the 20th century, we saw a decline, a general decline in religious expression. While among the Reformed community, we saw thanks to guys like Martin Lloyd-Jones, Banner of Truth, and the Reconstructionists, we saw a rise in publishing and teaching materials. But you have to realize, of course, that was a very, very, very small sliver of the whole. Okay. So what you're watching there, and we get really excited that the ACCS is now up to like, what is it, like 400 schools, Association of Classical Christian Schools. It's like up to four. There are literally like 6,000 Catholic schools in New York City alone. It's like we're such a small, we're a small group. We're a very small subsection of the world. Christian Smith is the guy who originated this term, moralistic therapeutic deism. That was a study that he did on millennials. It was the largest study of the religious life of teenagers that had ever been conducted. Went all over the country, surveyed thousands and thousands of teenagers at the time. All those people are now in their 30s. Okay, they're all grown up, and they are maybe having kids, maybe marrying, but they're growing up and they're moving on in their life. But he surveyed them when they were teenagers, and what he found to be constant among them, okay, these are Christian teenagers, people who identify as Christians. What he found to be just constant, in the regardless of where you were in the U.S., they described God in terms, in almost deistic terms. I think he's there, but I don't know, right? He seems distant. It wasn't a close personal relationship, walk with God, my covenant with God. They didn't describe it in terms like that. I hope he's up there. I know that there's a judgment. That's what deism maintains. I think he was involved at the beginning of the world. That's deism. Okay. But what they were heavily into is making me feel. It makes me feel. This is a feely generation. It's all about the feels. What I want to feel better. I go to God to feel better. I'm looking to feel better. It was very heavily saturated in that kind of language. But what Christian Smith noticed was that, and he interviewed many of these people, what was alarmingly lacking was the typical Christian content. The Apostles' Creed stuff, Lord's Prayer stuff, basics of the Christian faith. They went to a church that had a doctrinal statement of some sort, but they couldn't tell you what it was. Couldn't tell you what it was. So he recognized this. This book was written 20 years ago, describing teenagers at that time. Those were millennials. They grew up. They moved on. Christian Smith, I don't know if he's written on this topic recently. I know that Gene Twenge wrote a book on the millennials, but it wasn't specifically about their religious beliefs, called Generation Me, is what it's called. But they are a very different breed from Gen Z. And Gen Z, there are still people that among Gen Z that go to church. It's actually a really interesting thing. I'm going to move on to the next slide and show you. This is religious. Sorry if you can't see this in the back. Basically, stuff on the left, that's us. We're the, what is that color, coral? That's not coral. What is this? These are the Protestants. These are the Protestants. Among the silent generation, okay, boomers, Gen X, you can see what's happening. Protestantism is in decline. Now, part of that was to be expected. This also includes liberal Protestantism, okay? In the mainline churches, I don't know if you've been. Go online at some point. Just pick a mainline church and go on their website. All of them are streaming their services still to this day because they've lost so many of their people. They've gone online and they haven't come back after COVID, these mainline churches. But you look at their streaming services, most of these churches will have 20 people, 30 people inside the building, and they will all be octogenarians. Okay, these people over 80. Okay, this is the mainline churches have been dying for quite a while, but this also represents the evangelicals. Okay, so among this generation, you can see that it's this pretty steady decline. Okay, and what is increasing here is nothing, is that like I just don't have any beliefs there, which is different than agnostic and atheist, okay? And other world religions and things like that been pretty constant. Catholics are in decline as well. Okay. This is another chart. Hello. Okay. But what this shows is people who have... Now, that other chart is maybe a little bit misleading. It's people who still identify with some belief system. This is the share of the total cohort that have no religious affiliation. So, you can see how this has changed. It's nearly 50% of Gen Z in 2021 have no religious affiliation. Okay? Up from 39% in 2016. Okay? Now, across all the cohorts, there has been an increase. It's most pronounced here, but it's also in each cohort, it's increasing. Okay? What does that mean? That means everybody is departing somewhat from religion. Everybody is moving away from religion, even the other generations. But these changes are most dramatically seen in this generation. Yes, sir?
Well, there's also this phenomenon with modern digital technology that people do answer surveys less. Right? So I'm just kind of wondering how they verify this data.
Yeah, can't speak. I don't have that information. But these aren't, obviously, they don't do surveys anymore by phone call. They used to do these things. Mostly these have to do with, like, focus groups, I think. The whole field of social sciences had to make huge changes. But they're finding other tools, and some of those tools are more powerful than the random phone call. One of the problems with the phone call type of a survey was that you had to find people at home, and it skewed the data because who was going to be home at a time when these people working would be able to contact them? Certain things were skewed in that direction. With the internet, it actually creates a more a less biased, less skewed results because it's asynchronous. You can send these surveys out and people can answer them when they feel. But you are right. People generally pay less attention to these things, I think, than they used to. Yeah. The study is the CES, which I forget what that acronym stands for, but it's one of the largest social science surveys that they do in the nation. Okay. Let's move on. All right. So I'm going to end with just real quickly three shocking developments that have taken place in the last 20 years that we've seen that are traceable somehow to digital media. Okay, we want to be really careful here not to place all the blame on digital media. Digital media came along at a time and a place. I would highly recommend that you all read a book by Carl Truman called, the one that you should read, probably it's easier, it's more accessible, is called Strange New World. And what he does is show how our world has been changing for the last 300 years, and what we think of as the sexual revolution and the digital revolution are actually these things that have been changing dramatically in our time. The seeds were sown back in Rousseau and the Enlightenment and Romanticism. So we don't place all the blame on the fact that kids have smartphones now, right? But one thing that is very alarming about Gen Z is that they are, well, just look at this. Gen Z are identifying as LGBT at around 20%. Let's just let that sink in. The national average is actually higher than it has been, partly because of that, but it's higher than it has been. It's increasing across all those cohorts, but it's the major change is taking place in this new generation, 1 in 5. 1 in 5 says I'm the L, I'm the G, I'm the B, I'm the T, or I'm the plus. Okay? Like I said, you dare not reduce this to the fact of smartphones. That's not why this is happening. A lot of this work was, you can't even go back to the 60s and say, like, it starts here with these radical professors in Berkeley and places like that. They were responding to something, and like I said, Truman is a really useful guide in tracing these philosophies through the last 300 years to see how it ends up that you can have a statement. His whole thesis is, how in the world did we get to this place where a guy can say, I am a woman in a man's body, and they're not treated like they have a psychosis. Okay, we now live in that day and age, but you have to go back much, much further than just the last decade or two to understand that. I'm reading this. I don't know if you guys can see this in the back. There are two main types of LGBT assimilation that are taking place. That are there's probably more, but there's two that I want to draw your attention to. One is pathological. And this is a real significant mental disorder that is happening. And by that, I mean it is showing up in strong depressive symptoms among specifically young ladies, teenagers, and it seems to be socially related, okay? One term that is used, I don't think I have it here, is rapid onset gender dysphoria. This is not something that we've ever seen in the history of the observable social sciences ever before. There have always been, to our knowledge, there have always been transgender people, okay? They have been disturbed people who feel a discomfort toward their body. They often grew out of it. It was almost always males, and it almost always expressed itself at a very early age, and they often grew out of it. It was a confusion. Sometimes it could develop into distress, very serious distress even. A lot of it depended on how it was handled with the community that they lived in and the types of social pressure that they were around, of how it was handled. Sometimes it persisted, and those people 50 years ago grew up to be cross-dressers, transsexuals, or something like that. Okay, sometimes. But it was quite rare. Quite rare. Very, very, much, much less than 1% of the population. This is something very, very different. Rapid onset gender dysphoria happens among teenage girls who have no history of distress about their gender. It appears out of nowhere. Their parents are left. We have no idea how this happened. But when scientists have investigated this, this is highly politically charged. People have lost their jobs just for doing research in this area and publishing research. These are not conservative Christians in these places. These are often atheistic, feministic lesbians doing this work, but they're trying to do honest work. What is happening here? And they face a lot of political pressure, but it's connected socially. So there will be a whole group of girls in high school that suddenly shows up, and they're all start taking testosterone together because they're all experiencing a kind of distress together. And what I believe is behind this I believe those girls really are. There is a real psychological trauma that they're experiencing. I think it's impossible to separate it from what's happening to girls broadly in our culture, which is that many of them are growing up with access to pornography, and they're deeply disturbed by it. It troubles them, as it ought to. It is troubling. And you think about it, if from a young lady's perspective, The troubling nature of that is that for many, many girls, it makes the whole thing repulsive to them, as it ought to. What they're seeing is repulsive, and that repulsive instinct pushes them away from the whole thing. Here's a way to opt out of this horrific scenario, right? So this lady, Abigail Schreier, again, not a Christian, she's a journalist. She's done a lot of work in this. She wrote a book called Irreversible Damage about this phenomenon. And it's fascinating. So one of the things is that these girls kind of go together often in groups. There are whole school systems in the Bay Area that have this massive population of transgender girls. Statistically, it's impossible. The word that would have been used for this normally, if it wasn't so politically charged, is a social contagion. It's a social contagion. It's just an idea that gets into the minds of people, and they see it as a useful option, an ideology even. Okay. Another factor that is leading to this is TikTok. TikTok has been extremely effective for pro transgender activists to get their message across. And it's the gospel of transgenderism. The gospel of transgenderism is telling young ladies that all of the things that go along with being a lady, which are definitely difficult and challenging. Puberty for ladies is hard, okay? Very, very hard. And that you can just, here's a pill. It's the gospel of tea. Just get your tea. And the legislation has come alongside to undermine the authority of parents. You can go to a Planned Parenthood and walk out of there with your first dose of tea in some states without parental consent, depending on your age. So parents are left like, what in the world? My daughter went away to college. She came back. She had a mastectomy and her hair shaved and she has some 5 o'clock shadow. How did this happen? How did this happen? She was not like this as a young lady. Okay, so that's the pathological side of this. The ideological side is that this is the this is a part of the religious system of the times. So we know as Christians, as thoughtful Christians, we know that there's always a religious system. And part of the religious air that is being breathed by all these people is the idea of queerness. It's a rejection of the binary. And so it's while they would not, see, there are many traditionally gay people that are looking at what's going on and they're deeply disturbed. Okay? And you can read a number of these traditional gay people who are looking at this and they're saying, this is weird. This is, what is happening is very, very strange. This is not what we thought would happen. And they're not of us. We're not with them. Because what is happening is this complete rejection of the gender binary. And in that, people adopt, you know, there's supposedly a spectrum, just this kind of spectrum of gender. And people are encouraged to find their place on that gender. And that's a very confusing message for young people. But it's filled with lots and lots of social and political capital. There's lots of reasons why for a teenager who's struggling with their identity that they would be seeking social capital. And this is, in some communities, this is a very quick way that you can do that. I know a young lady who knew her for about 12 years. And she seemed, she had some issues with relationships, came from a broken home. But gender-wise, she was perfectly normal. And there wasn't anything that ever expressed itself in that way. But she went to a Christian college where she met a very radicalized little community of people, all of them queer, all of them rejecting the binary. And lo and behold, she's having a mastectomy. Makes no sense. But in her community where she's identifying now, that's part of the philosophy, to reject it, to show allegiance to this new normal. Okay? That's something happening in the world today that's deeply disturbing. I hope you're deeply disturbed by that. Our communities, probably, we don't sense this as much. Paideia, St. Stephen's, we don't see this as much. But this is what's happening all over the place, all around us. And there's no reason why we're to believe that this 20% is going to stay put. So, did digital media cause this? No. Is it magnifying this, amplifying this? Yes, very, very much so. Okay, people are being philosophically, they're being assaulted on TikTok, Twitch. Twitch, you go and watch people play video games. But a lot of them are talking all the time. And talking about their beliefs and talking about it's fascinating, and on and on. YouTube filled with more content on it than all of recorded human history, and a lot of that content is absolute philosophical garbage, unbelieving garbage, and it's harming young people. Another development, and we'll finish with this, is This is something that I'm going to want to spend more time on next week. To me, as a teacher, it's deeply disturbing. We are the first generation of people. Well, we'd say it rather like this. Gen Z is the first generation of people with near 100% literacy rates. And near 100% illiteracy rates. Okay? In fact, they are the only generation to actually where illiteracy is this massive statistic. So let me explain what illiteracy, illiteracy, and literacy are. Literacy is knowing how to read. Okay? Our Puritan forefathers created the first civilization there in the New World that had near 100% literacy rates. They taught everybody to read. It was essential. That has been a part of the Christian program from the beginning, from the time of the founding of the church. Okay, the schools, teaching people to read. But with the printing press, suddenly schools for reading popped up everywhere. And this science and this energy and this endeavor came to this wonderful apex in the early colonial period and then spread to Europe. Many European countries, most European countries now, have near 100% literacy rate. Almost everybody can read at some level. There is an issue of functional literacy. It's like we for some reason, our educational system, we kind of peek out and think that we're pretty good when we don't realize we're not learning how to read very, very difficult texts. We don't keep doing that hard work, okay? But what is happening, and I'm going to finish with this because we got to go, is they've been surveying people since the 70s. What do you read in your spare time? Always, they survey high school seniors, college freshmen, college graduates. What do you read in your spare time? This is the first, this last 5, 6, 7 years, the first time that the normal answer for those people is I read nothing, ever. Outside of schoolwork, nothing. Previous generations, it was always somewhere. Maybe it was just magazines. Maybe it was just comic books. We're living in a time when TV is considered a legacy media and a sign of some kind of like familial stability. If like a whole family gathers around and watch TV, okay? But the legacy media is gone. There was an idea that was presented with digital media that was sold to us that with the Kindles and things like that, we are going to be reading wildly. And the exact opposite has happened. Gen Z doesn't read unless you're telling them to read. They don't read. And those numbers are less so for other generations, but they are also increasingly becoming true. Illiteracy. It's here. What do we do about it? We'll find out next class. Okay, let's pray. Lord, we thank you for preserving your church through difficult times. You give us many blessings. You also present us with these great challenges. Lord, we are not adequate for such things, but we know that you are, and your plans and purposes will never fail. And we pray that you would receive us now in worship of you and summon us into your presence, and we joyfully accept that. In Christ's name, amen.